Welcome. This is the workshop on raising poets. And as with the fiction workshop, I have to start with a few poems so we know what we're talking about. And then I want to get into all sorts of issues, the oddness, weirdness of poetry, why men don't like poetry, things like that. Let me start with this one. This is from Ted Kooser's book, Weather Central. He was poet laureate a few years ago. This one's called The Time of Their Lives, and it encapsulates a lot of the things that I want to focus on in this talk, and I'll read a couple others too. The Time of Their Lives. Today, my ducks are eating windfalls under the broken Jonathan tree. Nine white pecans laughing like nuns on a picnic, rolling the apples around in the grass with their orange bills, having the time of their lives. Nothing escapes them. Near them, a red leaf rides the long grass in a papery rattle. A sweat bee deep in the apple sucks the tart cider. A lacy elm leaf sifts the wind, their black eyes sparkle. There is already ice in the reeds at the edge of the pond. I have built a cage in the dark garage. For tomorrow they go to a hard young farm wife, easy with killing. They will be packaged like gifts, heavy as hearts. Their cage is sturdy, quick to close. As my hammer tapped, they arched their necks to hear better the tick of scales. As a bull snake passed. Above the cry of my table saw, they heard a hawk's wings dust the blue bowl of the sky. Another from Ted Kooser. This one's called Four Secretaries. Four Secretaries. All through the day I hear or overhear their clear, light voices calling from desk to desk. Young women whose fingers play casually over their documents, setting the incoming checks to one side, the thick computer reports to the other, tapping the correspondence into stacks while they sing to each other, not intending to sing, nor knowing how beautiful their voices are as they call back and forth, singing their troubled marriage ballads, their daycare, car park, landlord songs. Even their anger with one another is lovely, the color rising in their throats, their white fists clenched in their laps, the quiet between them that follows. And their sadness, how deep and full of love is their sadness when one among them is hurt and they hear her calling and gather about her to cry. A couple others. This one's by Henry Taylor, short one. It's called Elevator Music. A tune with no more substance than the air, performed on underwater instruments, is proper to this short lift from earth. It hovers as we draw into ourselves and turn our reverent eyes toward the lights that count us to our various destinies. We're all in this together, the song says, and later we'll descend. The melody is like a name we don't recall just now that still keeps on insisting it is there. And one last for our opening. This is by Robert Wrigley. And this poem is Do You Love Me? She's 12 and she's asking the dog, who does, but who speaks in tongues, whose feints and gyrations are themselves parts of speech. They're on the back porch, and I don't really mean to be taking this in, but once I've heard it, I can't stop listening. Again and again she asks, and the good dog sits and wiggles, leaps and licks. Imagine never asking. Imagine why. So sure you wouldn't dare or couldn't care less. I wonder if the dog's guileless brown eyes can lie. If the perfect canine lack of abstractions might not be a bit like the picture books she read as a child before her parents' lips shaped the daily miracle of speech and kisses and the words were not lead and weighed only air, and did not mean so meanly. Do you love me, she says, and says, until the dog, sensing perhaps its own awful speechlessness, tries to bolt. But she holds it by the collar and will not let go, until having come closer, I hear the rest of it, I hear it all. She's got the dog's furry jowls in her hands. She's speaking precisely into its laid back, quivering ears. Say it, she hisses. Say it to me. Okay. So what is poetry? You get four examples before us, and I have some others as we go through to exemplify some things. On the outline, I wanted to switch a couple things around. I wanted to talk about something in general first, the purpose of the arts. I think it makes more sense to talk about that before talking about the differences between them. But poetry is an odd thing. I mean, you have to always look at these subjects as if you're coming from Jupiter or something and you land on Earth. And why is it that would drive someone to spend their life crafting little tiny squares of words? To what end? It just looks sort of odd. And you could say that about all the arts, too. If you're a marble sculptor or something, why? You have to explain to the alien, do you want to shape this in a certain way? Is it just fun? What's the purpose of making sculptures? And then, films look even weirder. Why do you have to throw these pictures and have people sit in the dark and stare at the screen for a couple hours? What's the purpose behind that? And I want to suggest this little thing is just a handy way. It's helped me try to understand, and it produces some criteria as well for the purpose of the arts. What are we? What are we doing? One of the most difficult things, especially I think, to sell this to guys, and especially poetry to guys, is that poetry and a lot of the arts just look like unnecessary decorations. Right? Poetry is just fancy language, and in a very important sense. Guys aren't interested in that. They're, got other things to do, especially, male students and so forth. Basketball's important and all. Why do I need to do something frilly? Why do I need to do something frilly? Well, and that's one of the biggest things I want to oppose. Poetry is not just decorative language. It's like the other arts in doing something weird, but it's not just unnecessary frilliness. That's not what it's about. So take 1 through 3 there and put them into one phrase, if you will. Capturing transcendence in a bit of matter to move the body. This is what the arts are about. This is what I think every artist of whatever sort, whether he or she's a composer, whatever it might be, this is what they're interested in doing. This is what's common between all the arts, and I think it's got a very deep Christian backing, but even secular artists, I think, follow this pattern. They may not articulate it this way, but it does help solve a bunch of odd problems. So capturing transcendence, figure out what that is in a second, capturing transcendence in a bit of matter to move a body. All right? So at least that second one explains the different arts. Sometimes we put things on a stage, that's a bit of matter, human bodies talking to one another. Sometimes we throw pictures on a wall. Sometimes we pick our words very carefully in a short space, and that's the matter. So sometimes through words, sometimes through marble, sometimes through images, sometimes through pitches for music and so forth. But those are different kinds of matter that we're interested in using. And so people become expert in bronze, become expert in pitches and so forth. And that's where their skills are. Number three is, and I'll come back to number one, number three is to move a body. And I think this is, especially on the artist side of things, if you know that you're doing this in order to move a human body, to excite or disturb or entrance a human body in some way, then it helps you tweak your art in a certain direction. And I'll get into some of this later, but I think in some prior centuries, they didn't have this so clearly worked out, and so they tend to want to move a mind, move an intellect, and not so much move an entire body. And we'll look at some poetry that's directed more at the intellect, and it's more of a puzzle, and that was very popular, and it's got its place in the tradition. I don't think in the long run it's as effective. But as you see, I think sanctification, I even call it, in the arts, you see that they're very interested in... And Joel, think of the poems we just read. Notice the one about the ducks, for example, by Ted Kooser. It starts off in a nice situation, describing nice ducks, but then it gets a little grim, right? We've got a dark edge to it, and we have committed ourselves to appreciating these ducks. Now they're threatened, and that calls something out of a body. And then we find out, well, this is part of farm life, and there's a huge irony here. The ducks are so attentive to little sounds, but they don't know what this man is doing. So there's this big divide between the ducks and the man building their death cage, in a sense. And so there's huge irony there. It's very, it draws our attention, but it's about building up sympathies and dashing them and trying to live as human beings. I think even more effective is the one about the poet overhears his daughter trying to speak to the dog. Right? There's this great magical element about speaking animals, and we know that childhood is tied to some great stories about speaking animals, and here's this sad, in a sense, but still wonderful aspect of this girl trying to get this dog to speak. And so there's a tragic, but again, very human element in there, and it says something about the human condition. But it's attempting to move us, to get our affections, to get our whole body. And I encourage you to do this as you watch, as you take part in any of the arts, whether you're listening to a symphony or watching a film. If you can sort of distance yourself from your body sometimes and notice what your body's doing in a film that you're sucked into. I mean, if you're really sucked into it, then you can't tell what your body's doing. But maybe it's that film just on the edge. You're sucked in parts, and then other times you can watch yourself watching the film. And it's very interesting. And, of course, artists learn techniques. Musicians, composers know how to move us. Filmmakers know how to move us, and there's nothing wicked and bad in that, because we learn it, I think, all through natural revelation. God does this all the time. So in a bit of matter, to move a body would be more effective than just moving an intellect. Okay? And I'll come back to that point. But that bit, capturing transcendence. Transcendence is another way of saying transcendence for my purposes, just the big story of life. What life is really all about. For Christians, of course, it's triune God, it's the gospel, it's creation, fall, redemption. And the idea, and I think this is the challenge for any artist, is to capture that, or a huge part of that, in a small bit of matter. Okay? Where it's an incarnation, right? It's an incarnation which is also right at the heart. And again, as I say, seculars are doing this as well. But here's what we do in the arts. It's fascinating to us, for some reason, to see the whole captured in just a bit. And it takes a lot of skill to do that so well, and then to move your audience in a certain way. So capturing transcendence, think of the poems we were just talking about. You know, again, the poem by Wrigley about the dog and the girl. Well, there's, again, this huge mythological element behind there, the difference between animals and humans. And he's able to capture that and put it there. Again, the non-sentimental part about ducks and animals, but even the elevator music, right? He even goes, he talks about it, hovers. We're all in this together, the song says. We talk about ascending and descending, huge aspects of Christian life, huge aspects of Western mythology, but it's just about elevator music. And trying to explain, here's this odd thing that we like, we dislike, and it sticks in our head, and we can't get rid of it, but we don't know the name of it. And it captures something. Yeah, this is what it's like being human. Life is often like that. You can't get rid of the elevator music. So all of these poems intend to do that. And I think you can use these as criteria with students, or just evaluating your own poems, that a poem, and this is a very common mistake with children, because they have a hard time capturing transcendence. Right? They sometimes don't know the big story and are able to pull it in. So I've got some tricks on how to encourage them in that. But and so many times you'll get, because pushing against that is telling them how to have good description, right? Good description. There's a great line in the one I was looking at about in Kooser's, where is it? It compares them to nuns, right? Today the ducks. Now I have to find this. There it is. Today my ducks are eating windfalls, which is an interesting image in itself. Nine white Pekins laughing like nuns on a picnic. Nuns on a picnic is a nice specific image that we can see, and there's an innocence to that. And of course, it adds to the tragedy, because now we're going to kill nuns in this poem. And so that's part of the technique. It wouldn't be, you know, if they were cheerleaders, it wouldn't be that interesting. Not that I didn't mean that it's okay to kill. Anyway, you understand. But it creates more tragedy in the poem. That still sounds bad. I can't get out of that one. Well, never mind. Capturing transcendence in a bit of matter to move a body. So the capturing transcendence, you can evaluate poems that fail to do this, that just give you frilly language or just give you decorative language, then that poem fails as a poem. It's a nice description. Children, you know, kids love to describe some tree in their backyard, and they'll give you all sorts of detail. And at the end, the question that they get tired of, but they learn slowly, is how does this rise above description? Why should I read this? I've got a tree in my backyard. I could probably get a prose writer to give a better description than I could, or than the poet here. So why should we be concerned? Well, they've left out one part of this. The capturing transcendence is important. In a bit of matter, it's very concrete language, right? The orange bills on the ducks, you know, various other aspects of the poems. Concreteness, and I'll come back to that. And of course, to move a body. If you have a poem that captures transcendence and it's very concrete, it's very incarnational in its description, I think, as these four poems were, and yet in the end we're not really moved, well, part of that is, you know, not every poem is for every audience, but most of the time it's the poet's fault. You can get most people to have some interest in a good poem. And so if it fails broadly and you've got to test out your poems broadly, then that would be another criterion to use. Okay. Another way of... So if we think of the arts in that direction, the purpose of the arts, capturing transcendence and a bit of matter to move a body, then we can talk a bit more about the differences, and I won't spend a lot of time here. The contrasts already, marble, pitches, action, dialogue, paint patterns, those are all different bits of matter. But within the literary tradition, of course, we get short stories, we get novels, and poetry, and prose itself is an art. One of the key aspects of poetry, though, is being condensed for the most part, unless we're talking about, you know, epic poems. But even those are condensed in a way differently than straight prose. But whereas in a novel, you seem to have a lot of space, right? You've got lots of pages, you can spend time introducing your audience to the world. In a poem, you know, some of the best poems are, you know, 4, 5, 6 lines long. You don't have a lot of space to do that. Some of those that I read are just little bits. And so the idea is to get rid of unnecessary words, to get rid of redundancy. This is something, you know, when you don't trust yourself as a poet, you'll see that students often will repeat things to make sure that the reader gets it. Well, you got to cut those things out. Poetry is not about repetition. Now, lyrics for music, those are about repetition, but there's a strong divide between lyrics and poetry, and sometimes lyricists and poets don't even consider themselves doing the same work. And we can get into that in questions if you're interested. But the idea is that being condensed is the power of a poem, trying to say something very powerful in a short bit of space. And so if you get a student with an 80-line poem, the idea is it probably doesn't need to be that long. Is it possible? How much of that can you cut out? So there's a constant pressure to minimize and say things in a short amount of space. So that's one of the glories of poetry. The other is to do with line-ins. Now, all the poems I read were, as we call, free verse. Free verse poetry really isn't free, and you can do anything you want. It's actually, in some ways, far more complicated than some traditional forms. You're thinking of 1,000 rules at once instead of 6 or 7. But the idea in both, whether traditional forms or free verse poems, is that we're very concerned with the line and where you break that line. And it's not arbitrary. There's a particular purpose. You can create stress and tension. You can finish a line and your reader has an expectation and you surprise them. Surprise, as we'll see, is a very important part of poetry. So those tend to be two unique characteristics of poetry. It's condensed, and we're very concerned with where the line breaks. Prose writers are not concerned, right? They just go and lap around. Prose writers could care less about where the line ends. That's not their focus. Their poetry, very crucial. And then, of course, compared to all the other arts, they're all trying to capture something big and universal in a small space. Let me go on to D. I've already chatted about C, but D is another way of thinking about poetry. Again, we tend to think of poetry as arbitrary and you can do anything you want in the modern context, or even if you're using traditional forms, it's open and so forth. You know, one of the strangest things that struck me from my poetry instructors was their obsession and concern, which I've passed on to my students, with precision. Precision. They are so absolute. You can, you know, refine a poem 30 times because they seem to be far more obsessed with precision than engineers and scientists and so forth. So precision was very important for poets. You've got to get exactly the right word, especially exactly the right image. And, you know, I would do various kinds of images and often it would come back, this image is imprecise. This image doesn't fit this. And we'll look at some bad examples here in a moment. But one way to summarize, again, one major strand of poetry. This is, you'll find counterexamples in different traditions. But I like to think of poetry as argument by image, argument by a literary image. Right? A film is an argument by an action image and so forth. A stage play is argument by dialogue. But the arts are always arguing. Okay, and sometimes this is a bad temptation for Christians because we always want to turn everything into a sermon. We want to turn everything into a bit of propaganda and so forth. And then that's a danger we have to watch out for. But still, even apart from our especially Protestant tendency to make everything into a lesson, make everything teach, poems and all the arts are arguments. Now, they don't come in syllogistic form, right? That's a logical argument. But they argue by image. And let me give you some examples. One of the things to help students is to try to get them only to think about image at times. And of course, that can push in the wrong direction ultimately. But as an exercise, trying to get them. Let me give you some examples of what I mean. And these are some of my students, and these are very short, and the idea is to give you some images, very specific images, and you draw a conclusion without the poet saying it. Right? You sort of fail as a poet. That's our understanding. You fail as a poet if you tell them if you tell your audience what they're supposed to think. And the same with film and most of the other arts. Same with natural revelation, right? God speaks to us through natural revelation, and at the base of Mount Everest, he doesn't say, this shows the glory of God. We're supposed to look at the mountain and infer that, and that's one of the neat things about natural revelation. And the arts imitate natural revelation, as I was saying earlier. We tend to want them to be special revelation, where everything's sort of laid out or laid out more. Here are a few. Arguments by image. Summer. She stands, this is a 12-year-old girl, Summer, the poet is, Summer. She stands next to her lemonade stand, sucking on a popsicle stick. Her hair sticks to the side of her mouth as she yells, 25 cents. Her first customer pulls up and she hands him a filled cup, the outside sticky and purple. Okay. Some nice, precise images. Right, I like the hair on the side of her mouth, the price, car pulls up, and the strongest image, you always want to end a poem with your strongest image, is this cup, right? Kids selling lemonade, and its outside is sticky and purple. Both of those are surprising. We haven't been set up to see this. But what it does is it captures something about childhood, right? This is how childhood business operates. It's kind of messy, and parents subsidize it, and so forth, right? And yet the kid thinks that he or she earns all this money, but hasn't had to provide the capital. And so all those things come back in when we see this. And the title is, of course, Summer, and she gives one little description, and it ties into a lot of other stuff. Here's one called Patience. The brown-haired boy with his bowl of milk loads cereal piece by piece onto a soup spoon. First you, then you, passengers boarding a shallow silver boat. He leaves the marshmallows bobbing like buoys soon a mouthful of blue moons. Okay? I think this is a brilliant poem. So we get drawn into this, we know this, we can identify with having played these sort of games as a kid. So there's this transcendence, the joy of childhood is an important part. And the dreams, right? Dreams, another theme coming on here. You can turn a spoon into a boat, right? You can do that as a child. And we still get this neat surprise, right? A mouthful of blue moons, which is a great line. It's a surprising line. It's not a cliche. And it tastes good, so it applies not just to the eyes, but to the mouth. And we know this sort of, this is not a romantic sort of thing. This is, just a common American cereal that, we're familiar with. This is another Ted Kooser. Late lights in Minnesota. At the end of a freight train rolling away, a hand swinging a lantern. The only lights left behind in the town are a bulb burning cold in the jail. High in one house, a 5-battery flashlight pulling an old woman downstairs to the toilet among the red eyes of her cats. Nice little images there, right? And it starts off from a distance camera, a lot of camera things going on. You start from a distant view, and you end up on the red eyes of those cats right at the end. And again, it's an argument by image. You can draw conclusions about that, sometimes several conclusions. The biggest conclusion that I think most poetry aims for, again, even secular poetry, is, I'm glad I'm alive. Isn't this a great thing to be part of? And especially for Christians, the joy of being created, right? Especially in the first two, summer and the cereal. Isn't it cool to be a human being? We get to do really stupid things that matter an awful lot. And poetry's great at grabbing that sort of thing. So those are some examples of argument by image. And some poems will focus on that more strongly than others. Combining E and F here, traditions of poetry, goals and purposes, and then the problem of intellectual and decorative poetry. They're tremendous, all sorts of traditions. In the Greek world, Roman world, and of course English tradition, Shakespeare on. We've got tremendous work in poetry. It's always difficult when a poem is set before you, unless you're really familiar with, okay, how should I appreciate this? How should I evaluate that? And as I said, I'll get to some of that. But one very helpful way, and especially helpful with students, is to talk about the goal of a particular poem. The goal of a particular poem. And in one workshop in grad school, they brought in an outside poet once. And she started the week-long poetry workshop by saying, I will never tell you I like one of your poems or that I dislike it. She says, that's not my job. Right? That's not what the job of poetry is. But we're going to talk about what you wanted to do as a poet, what your goal was in that poem, and whether you provided the steps to reach that. And so it becomes much less a personal attack. I mean, whenever you're doing the arts sort of thing, it's hard. Even if you take that tack, people will get offended and so forth. And so as a teacher, you've got to have a lot of credibility already that you really adore these students and want to encourage them in this, but there's an awful lot of red ink that goes on poems and stories and so forth. But it does provide some interesting distance. It's not about the poet. It's not about, this childhood moment. To care less about that. I want to know, did you put the steps in there to effectively have that great last line? Or sometimes you can figure this out. Sometimes it looks like they're trying to do one thing, but they provide stanzas that do something entirely different. So when we're thinking about traditions of poetry, that's also a way to look at the past as well. Right? So there might be a particular tradition in poetry that doesn't move my body now. There are plenty of them when you read them. And especially in classical schools, we tend just to look at things outside the 20th century. And so that creates a certain picture of what poetry is. And all the poems that I've looked at are 20th century poems, because I do think there's some progress. But at least one way of looking at those poems, even if I might personally not like it, I can ask, did the poet accomplish what he or she was aiming at? Okay? And let me suggest one. This is from Ben Jonson, poet in Shakespeare's time. And I'm listing this as a bad poem. I don't think he achieves what he wants to achieve. I think he wants to move us, and I know I'm prejudicing it, but you know, it's my talk, I can prejudice. It tends to be more intellectual, not very visual. Tends to be, and a lot of, again, Shakespeare is wonderful, giving us very sharp images, and even in his sonnets. But this one is more abstract. This one sounds more like a bureaucrat talking. And it's on a very difficult subject, on my first son. Right? You know, usually I tell my students, you can't write poems about, you know, dead bunnies or springtime. Right? Everybody wants to write about springtime. Great poets can write about springtime, but you may not. Because, you know, it just automatically gets too shiny and so forth. So this is on my first son. I would normally ban this topic, but we know that he wants to move us in a certain way. Or we expect that as an artist. So he says, on my first son, farewell, thou child of my right hand and joy. My sin was too much hope of thee, loved boy. 7 years thou wert lent to me, and I thee pay, exacted by the fate on the just day. Oh, could I lose all father now, for why will man lament the state he should envy? To have so soon scaped world's and flesh's rage, and if no other misery yet age, rest in soft peace, and ask, say here doth lie Ben Jonson, his best piece of poetry, for whose sake henceforth all his vows be such as what he loves may never like too much. Okay? Now, compare the, you know, what you can remember from that poem that I just read to some of the other ones. I bet you could still remember the red eyes of those cats, the blue moons, things like that of the other poems, the sticky cup. Right? Those were nice, sharp images. We don't get any of that in here. And it's not just to say they weren't interested in that, because, again, a contemporary of his, Shakespeare, is very interested in that and does amazing stuff. But certainly he wants to move us to make some sort of memorial there, but uses a very intellectual approach. He's writing more to the intellect than to move our bodies. And then you have to ask all sorts of questions about any poem. Whenever there's rhyme or not rhyme, you have to ask, what's the purpose of it? Nothing's arbitrary in there. Why would you, you know, have rhyme in a poem? What's the meaning of rhyme, you have to ask? And then how does it help strengthen this poem? And this is a poem about death. We expect disorder, chaos. I mean, nothing could be worse. He's lost a seven-year-old? I can't imagine. Could never write a poem about that. It'd be so horrific, number one. But if someone's going to attempt it, it's got to bring out sort of the worst parts of human life. And so we've got the rhyming there. Well, yeah, it was part of the time, but not everyone was rhyming at that point. It makes it sort of sing-songy. Does he want sing-songiness at this point when he's writing about the death of the child? It doesn't seem to fit his subject, right? When you look at, you know, some of Hamlet's speeches, some of the most fierce ones, you know, they're not rhyming at that point, though Shakespeare will often use rhyming in comical contexts. So again, you have to think about everything when you're writing a poem. Does rhyming help here, or does it distract me? Why aren't there more precise images to move my body rather than my intellect and so forth? But again, it's not whether I like it or not. I can ask, what's his goal? His goal seems to be to do some sort of memoriam about the death of a child. Does he reach that? Don't think the rhyming helps. Don't think the lack of images really helps toward that goal. And it doesn't seem as strong as some other poems there. And you could go on. But those are just an illustration of goals and purposes, and also to help bring out F there, intellectual and decorative poetry. You will often find in the Western tradition a lot of decorative poetry. They could have written this as straight prose, and it would have been interesting. It might have been more interesting if it were just straight prose, and there's some paradox, some intellectual thing they want us to get. Well, just let me read the straight prose. Don't try to make it fancy by putting it in poetry. And this is one of the things you have to overcome as a teacher, too. Students come with certain assumptions about what poetry is, and you have to tell them, no, you're not, you know, some Elizabethan bard, right? You're an 11-year-old, right? And I want you to talk using your words and not pretend to be a 30-year-old with these and thous and so forth. That's not how you talk to your parents, right? No, okay. Well, then I want you to write like a human being, you as a human being now, and use simple, clear words. And then, again, the pressure on precision, pressure on, don't be flowery for flowery's sake. Again, it doesn't meet the goal. Let me not spend a lot of time on section 2, because I really want to spend the time on section 3, giving you some more bad and good examples, but just highlight a few things. How does poetry fit into classical education? For the grammar stage, I really do want to recommend Matt Whitling's book from Logos Press about poetry. It does great things about that. Again, you're not really pushing the grammar stage to be creative and, you know, capture transcendence and so forth. Get them the feel of meter and the glory of sounds and get them to enjoy all that. And I'll have some examples in a moment. Especially, there's a lot of great poems out there for students that don't condescend, right? You want to sort of shoot above their heads. All the poems I've been looking at, most of them have been directed to an adult audience. Well, not Summer and Patience and the dog one. Elementary can even appreciate that. But you don't want to give them childish poems in a very important way. You want to name them higher than that. So in the grammar stage, huge centrality of imagination. We're developing hypotheticals, the world of the subjunctive, trying to get them to think about different ways to look at common things. One of the ways we talk about poetry as apart from argument as an image is to get them to look at ordinary, the glory in the ordinary. Right? The glory in the ordinary. A lot of poetry is good at that. Show us what's really interesting about something that's just very ordinary. If you have corn growing at your house, tell me about that corn in a way that I've never heard before, or that's surprising. Combine things in there. But not trying to do, big poems about shipwrecks and so forth. No, just tell me about the corn in your backyard and why is it glorious. Right? And use very simple words. And don't tell me that it's glorious. Let me read your images and infer, wow, corn is really great. I'm glad I'm creative. That sort of thing, the constant pressure. Again, grammar stage, you're not pushing on that so much, but you can push on the simple. And then logic stage, we get higher into contrasting poetic worlds, trying to think about different ways, trying to surprise us, right? You can emphasize the surprise part when you get to the logic stage, and that every poem should knock us out of this world, remember, in a certain way. That's what a surprise is. Make us rise above sort of the daily trivialities of life. And remember that cereal with the blue moons in it, right? That's a neat thing to remember. And of course, in any of the art, well, especially the literary arts, you have to constantly think of counterexamples and how to overcome cliches. And of course, people in the logic stage, all they know is cliches, because that's a good thing. They need to learn the cliches before they can turn them around, make them interesting. And so you've got to mark those cliches. This is the way everybody describes mother or a dog or something like that. So now we know what your meaning is. Now give me something, a different way of saying that same sort of thing. When you get to the rhetoric stage, then you're full-blown into recreating worlds, and we're expecting more precision and imaginative maturity. But let's get some more practical things out there, teaching poetry. Right? Oh, let me recommend one book. There are all sorts of great books. Again, if you go on Amazon and look up books on poetry writing, you find a lot of great ones. And some of you were in the short story or the fiction class, and I said just about anything you get on fiction is good. But it's not the same with poetry. There are a lot of bad books on teaching poetry. Nothing horrendous, but they will just focus on one thing. One after, teaching... And I've used this in a rhetoric level class. Western Wind, it's been around. This is by David Mason, is one. This is the fourth edition. I think there are seven editions now. But Western Wind, An Introduction to Poetry, David Mason. He gives some great arguments and countless examples, again, from older traditions and from contemporary poets about all sorts of things. In fact, I'm going to read a section in just a moment. But great arguments for rhyme, when to use rhyme, when not to use rhyme, and the purpose of it, and so forth. So let me recommend that one. We were thinking of three things when we're talking about teaching poetry. And again, grammar stage, you do want to be thoroughly, students should be thoroughly familiar with all the traditional forms. One of the mistakes is students think that once they can master a sonnet form, and I've not gone into any of this for those that aren't familiar with it, or any of the old forms, that they're writing poetry. And usually a form is a great thing. It's like the pressure to be condensed. It makes you work in a certain way. You know, if you're a sculptor, you have to work in bronze or in marble, and those are like forms as well. You have to work within that material. So those are all good and important, but you're only 10% of the way, I'd say, once you've worked in that. And you've already got 1,000 things to be thinking about, so I tend to start my students working on free verse poems and getting them to focus on image and tension and transcendence, and then later work into sonnets and so forth. Now, whichever way you do it, grammar stage, right, the Matt Whitling stuff teaches you some of that early on, and it's great to have it in mind, especially the meter part. But when I'm teaching students, contents, techniques, and then broader criteria, but in terms of contents, as I've emphasized already, you want to write the simple thing. You want to focus on the simple and not get intellectual, but focus on a bit of the created order, I say. And then urging them to rise above description. So they get it all done, they breathe hard, they've had to juggle 900 rules, and then the mean teacher comes back and says, but what's the point? You just described something very nicely, but it doesn't tell me, it doesn't capture the big themes of life. And you'd think it'd be hard, as I mentioned, it is hard, especially for grammar level, but for junior high and above, they can capture these things. And let's say they can't, and they get really frustrated. I've had some students just tell me, I don't know what you mean by capturing the big story, transcendence. Then I say, well, sometimes it comes in magically. If you just focus really well on giving me a very specific imagistic detail, sometimes you can focus on that apple or that event with such great detail that even without you intending it, this transcendence shows up. And this is what happened in the poem about selling Kool-Aid. Right? We went through a couple versions. It was twice as long. There's all sorts of redundant things we didn't need. And she was very frustrated. She's a very gifted poet, but never really got the transcendence thing. I said, well, don't worry about that. Just tell me more interesting, surprising details about this lemonade. And then she came back with sticky and purple. And that was perfect. And she didn't know how it captured childhood the way it affected me, but she was able to do that. So sometimes you can just press them to be more precise and more interesting. That's the biggest part, is to getting them to be interesting. And you can even push on that in the grammar. Though the grammar students tend to be a little more frail, and you tend to want to encourage them. The logic and the rhetoric, you can break them, push them a little harder and say, this is still boring. I need something interesting. Right? Don't say it like the way everybody else does. So writing the simple, rising above description, creating tension is another one. In all the poems that we've looked at, there is some dark edge, right? And this is why this is an important Christian contribution. It's very easy to go sentimental, to go romantic when you're doing poetry, because those are the expectations we bring in. But many times I'll urge students, look, especially if they have a problem, they give me 3 spring poems or something, and finally, as I said before, tell them, no spring. You may not write about spring. So I ask them to write about something that is unpleasant, right? They found a dead rabbit in their garden, a dead wild rabbit. I said, that's a perfect subject. Write about that dead rabbit that you come upon, and then it forces them to try to talk about what was interesting about that. And then, of course, they can back off. I think I've ever told anyone to write about something ugly, but you need the ugly in there, right? That's part of attracting anyone's attention. You've got to have that tension in a film, right? Within the first 17 minutes, there is some major conflict going on. If we don't have it, then we're not pleased with that film. Novels, short stories, music as well. Tension is huge. Bach is described as someone who knew exactly, right, the amount of consonants and dissonance to put together. And that's why he becomes a master, because he always had dissonance in there. And the same sort of thing. You need that dissonant angle in a poem, and getting students to bring it out. Sometimes you have to look at the subject and bring it out and ask them questions about that corn. Were there any brown leaves on the corn? Was there any suggestion of death or fall or something like that? So creating that dissonance. 4, avoiding sentimentalism. I've already said several things about that. That's the tendency. And this is, again, especially as good Christian students, they want to write about gratitude. And so they'll describe something great their parents did, something wonderful, or some feast that they had. All good subjects, very difficult to write poems about. to write poems that make something, the conclusion be, isn't this a great object? Because you naturally drift away from any tension, and you drift away from any dark edge, because this is a really neat thing Mom did, and so you want to write a poem about it. But so it's very hard to hold the tension. So generally, you try to get an event rather than just an object, and an event that's got some problem, some fall there. And number five, you start getting a pattern as you focus on images, focus on character, focus on people. People are especially interesting. They tend to just want to write about nature, and one way to get them to write the dark side is to get people in there, because people always have some dark edge, and kids can notice this very well. So choosing the photographic moment, as I mentioned in the prior talk, photographers don't just take pictures of everything. They've got an eye. They've developed an eye to take a picture of a particular thing that's interesting. It's got some tension in it, actually. And poets are the same way. You've got to constantly, as they get into the habit of what works as a poem and what doesn't, they'll start watching for poetic moments. With my own kids, my daughters are very good poets. And sometimes we'll be in some family moment and we all try to claim that. Oh, that's a poetry moment. It's mine. No, it's mine. No, it's mine. It's mine. Okay. Well, whoever did it first. Okay, all right. And they always beat me. But you've got to develop that eye, and that comes with time. Let's look at some techniques. So those are questions about content, what to avoid, what to try to focus on. Techniques themselves, I've hinted at some of these, but I want to give you some examples. So sensory precision versus ambiguity. And let me combine number four with this and give you some examples from Western Wind. Showing versus telling. I've hinted at the showing versus telling thing when I've said that you can't list the conclusion in the poem. The last line can't be, "and that was a glorious feast." No, failure as a poem. Can't do that. It shows up often when you're doing that. I just want to know about the food. I want to know about also the food that fell on the floor. And I want to know all the great parts. And even with some slight dark edge, it can still be a great celebratory poem. But let's get some ideas here, again, about this concrete versus abstract ideas, because this is something that takes training and practice. Here's the abstract idea, and then here are some famous poets, usually Shakespeare in this case. The abstract idea is, we mean you no harm. We mean you no harm. How could you put that in more specific and more concrete images? To you, our swords have leaden points, Mark Antony. Okay. Just because, here's the idea, just because you're so proper, does that mean other people cannot enjoy themselves? Dost thou think, because thou art virtuous, there shall be no more cakes and ale? Great way of saying it. Here's the idea. Though he is prosperous and secure, you can annoy him in little ways. Here's the poetic version. And though he in a fertile climate dwell, plague him with flies. Make the best of it, idea. Men do their broken weapons rather use than their bare hands. We cannot trust anyone. Where we are, there's daggers in men's smiles. Okay? Now notice this isn't frilly language. This is precise images. A dagger and a smile is a great, very precise image. Ungrateful children are a source of suffering to their parents. Poetic version. How sharper than a serpent's tooth it is to have a thankless child. I have much to worry about is the idea. Oh, full of scorpions is my mind, dear wife. My mind full of scorpions. People who fail lose many friends. Poetic version. Men shut their doors against a setting sun. I often change my mind is the idea. I am a feather for each wind that blows. I'm drawing on some biblical allusions. And if you keep this in mind and look at, especially, New Testament, Book of James tends to be one of the more poetic books. But even something we think is straight theology is Romans. And you have these sort of things in mind, you see that the Book of Romans is a highly poetic book. He uses image after image and changes them and alters them. You have to be a poet, really, to read the Book of Romans well. So sensory precision, precision versus ambiguity. You get a poem, and let me give you some... some bad ones before I get too far in this. Let me get a few more. Sorry, I want to do that. Causing surprise versus a cliche. I mentioned that. You want to try. You don't want to say things the way they're normally said in everyday talk. You want to bring in some surprising element. Trimming repetitiveness and redundancy, right? It's redundant, that line right there. You want to get rid of anything that isn't necessary. If we've already been introduced to something, we don't need to be. Don't need it described again. Showing versatility, shaping the order of information. The order of things is very important many times, especially to set up for surprise, especially to for us to understand. A lot of students think that poetry is supposed to be obscure, and there was a moment in the 50s and 60s where poets tried to be obscure, but everything from the 70s on, there's been a push, even by secular poets, just to be clear. And there's enough confusing parts of poetry in the condensed area that nobody wants to be unclear anymore, because you end up being a failed poet. So Ted Kooser tends to be a common sort of poet. And if you open up a typical poetry journal now, you can understand the poems very clearly. So they're not trying for obscurity. Sometimes students think that, well, poetry is supposed to be obscure language. No, it's exactly the opposite. So shaping the order is important. Sometimes we're in something and it looks like a dance, it looks like a feast. I tell a student, I have no idea where I am. I don't know what I'm supposed to picture here. I need more information. Or move this bottom paragraph or stanza up above. Number six, writing for others, not yourself. Right? We often come in modern, these are some of the older students who have picked this up, that you know, poetry is about me and my private experience. And the answer is no, we're Trinitarians. It's all about other people. It's not about what's going on inside of you. You are speaking to an audience, and you're being disrespectful to the audience in your poem if they're not invited into this dance. You have to be clear enough and not just talk about your own private experience. So we're writing for an audience, and that means that sometimes we have to make things clear and not just, you know, be the torn romantic poet that, you know, sticks by his or her words. That's not what it's about. It's a gift to others. And then number seven, I've already hinted at this in the rhyming, tracking the purpose of every detail. Why are we rhyming in this poem? Why have you arranged the lines in this way? Why did you break this line here? Why this image to get me to this other image? And so forth. All right, well, let's look at a couple of bad ones from students. They went on and improved these, and so I've just taken a few. This one's called Dumpster Cat. You can imagine. Right? I can imagine the story behind this. She wanted to write about her cat. I said, no, I don't want to hear about your nice, pretty cat. Tell me about an ugly cat. So this one's Dumpster Cat. So she's trying. Right? He was found by a dumpster in the parking lot, much too small for his age. Maybe his mother deserted him. Maybe he ran away. His ears are much too big and mouse-like. His right eye is blue. The left is brown. When put in his crate, he cries to be let out. When out, he burrows in my arms and purrs deep in his chest. But in spite of this, I too must leave him. Goodbye, my dumpster cat. Okay. Now, we know the goal of this, right? She wants us to feel bad about this cat, and that's fine. Right? We can take that as a goal. But none of it is goodbye, my dumpster cat. First, it just makes us laugh, and so the poem fails there. There are some good images. You probably guessed. My favorite is his right eye is blue, the left is brown. That's a great image. We can picture that. We've seen animals like that. But there's some, you know, speculation here. Maybe his mother deserted him. No, maybe. You're a poet. You're a prophet. You're supposed to be telling us the truth here. Don't speculate about, you know, what could have been here. Ears are mouse-like. That's okay. He cries to be let out. Burrows in my arms and purrs deep in his chest. You know, cat purring, that's pretty common cliche. It's not going to surprise. We expect cats to do that. But in spite of all this, I too must leave him. That just gets sentimental and sad. She's trying to force the sadness conclusion on us. And so let the reader get that, right? Just describe me this dumpster cat. Tell me about this, and maybe even leave the human being out of this one, right? Because it could too easily fall into sentimentalism. And they learn quickly. Even, you know, young girls who, you know, seem to be drawn that way can turn things around. Now, of course, the other, when you get the guys, right, they just want to write about brutality sometimes. When I talk to them about not writing about springtime, and it's, for some reason, it's easier to rein them in because you're asking them to write about their regular lives, and, you know, they don't hang out with serial killers or war, you know, so they bring it in. But you have to try to get them to have some sense of, you know, human perspective. You know, where's the human here? It's not just about the dead rabbit. Oh, that's the other complaint about a dumpster cat. You know, there's not a lot of transcendence here. It's just a lot of description. But she's trying. She knows I'm going to ask about transcendence, so she brings the human in there to feel sad. But that doesn't really pull it off. So what is, in other words, what we're asking is, what's the meaning of the dumpster cat? What's the meaning of the dumpster cat? And that's a hard one for students, but at least for you, God has a meaning for the dumpster cat, right? There's something about humans in there. Here's another one. Again, he's learned some of the lessons, and this one's called the table. Rickety it stands, supported by a set of stairs and shelves. One on either side to keep it standing firm on its four legs, and constructed of some old growth cedar, put together like a jigsaw puzzle of brown boards and pegs. Made 3 feet by two, it was a very small dining table for a time, but now set aside and hid by the books it holds, with one chair in front, it is called a desk. Like a revered old man, it stands aside, but is not ignored. Okay? Now there's some pluses. It's heading in the right direction, but we do get redundancy, right? We get we're told three times that there are four legs and that this is a table. Okay, we trust your audience. We'll get it that it's a table. You don't have to tell me two or three times, right? We're given several descriptions of it, and it's largely just a description. Again, he sneaks in the person at the end, or at least the simile, like a revered old man. But that's a cheating word. Here's another very important aspect here. That word rickety, but especially revered, right? We tell students, leave out the judgment words. Let the reader make the judgment. Okay? So you want to include adjectives that are very precise about, even old growth cedar. That's fine. That sort of thing. Describing the physical properties. But you want to be like a camera, right? That's what I keep... If a camera were looking at this table, what would it see? And it would not see rickety, right? That's a judgment sort of word. It would see, splintered wood. It would not see a revered old man, because revered is the judgment we impose on things. Cameras don't capture that. So if you're working on images, think in terms of what a camera captures. And again, students learn this. And I'll be going through a poem and they'll jump in and say, oh, that's a judgment word. I didn't realize it. Yeah, okay. So let's cut it out and try to get something camera-like there. So those are some ways to bring these criteria to that. And again, there's no simple answer. You have to look at a lot of poems, and you're constantly, the teacher asking, well, how could we make this poem work better? And the students quickly appreciate that. C section there, I really have covered in various ways. The why care test is the big one. Why should I care about this poem? Poem's not written about the poet. It's not written just about a bit of matter. It's supposed to change my body somehow. It's supposed to make me react and your audience react. So you always have to keep asking, why should we care? And I'll leave it at that. Thank you very much.